1963 by Niall Boyce. The man cowered before his attacker, his right hand raised to fend off the blow. The knife his assailant was using was familiar to Barbara. For a brief period in her teens, during what her mother called her rebellious phase, she had dated a boy who carried one. It was a flick knife. Its blade was folded in the handle and released at the touch of a button. The blade wasn't fully extended. It stood at an angle, the exposed metal catching the ray of sunshine that punched through the clouds and into the alley. It was the glimmer of the knife that had caught her eye as she walked through the streets that bordered Trafalgar Square, trying to find some sign of life in the silent metropolis. Barbara stepped nearer and looked at the men more closely. Both were perfectly still. The man holding the knife was dressed in a long, dark raincoat and had a black trilby pulled low over his brow. His victim wore a double-breasted pinstriped suit torn at the knees. His hair, tangled and lathered with sweat, was plastered across his forehead. Barbara leaned forward and touched it. It was hard under her fingers. It was neither warm nor cold, and there was no sensation of dampness. The individual strands of hair felt like firm, unmalleable wires. She turned her attention to the knife. She pressed against the blade, tentatively, trying to close it, but it refused to budge. She applied more force, but it stood defiantly open, as if it had been welded into position. Barbara stood back and examined the frozen tableau in front of her. Who were these men? Gangsters? Spies? A jealous husband and his rival? There was no way of knowing. Perhaps there never would be. Reluctantly, she turned and walked back out of the alley to continue her search for life. Barbara had woken that morning to the pleasing aroma of freshly brewed coffee. Vicky sat at the end of her bed, holding a small round tray made of see-through material. On it rested a steaming mug and a food bar.
"Breakfast is served," said Vicky.
Barbara lifted the mug carefully and took a sip. She hadn't slept well. Usually the TARDIS produced a smooth sensation in flight. It was like falling without the prospect of hitting bottom. The journey last night, however, had felt erratic. The movements of the ship, jerky and staccato. Vicky held up the food bar.
"Bacon and eggs," she said.
Barbara took it in her free hand and nibbled at it. The warmth, taste and texture of a full English breakfast filled her mouth. This morning, though, there was something else.
"Brown sauce," said Vicky. "Ian said you liked it, so I added it to the program. It took ever so long."
"Thanks," said Barbara.
"It's nothing,"
said Vicky.
"Anyway, you'd better get dressed and come to the control room. The doctor has something to show you. He's ever so excited about it, you can't imagine."
"What is it?" Barbara asked. But in response, Vicky had only recited part of a poem about Lady Chatterley's lover and the Beatles' first LP that she hadn't recognised. In any case, she wasn't sure it was the sort of thing girls of Vicky's age should know by heart. Barbara finished her breakfast, washed, put on her capri pants and pullover, and headed for the control room. The doctor and Vicky were waiting for her there. They exchanged a mischievous glance as she came in. It sometimes seemed to her that she saw the spark of a younger man in the doctor's eyes, whilst Vicky was the most precocious young lady she'd ever met. Perhaps, in some way, that made them equals.
So, what's this surprise?
Barbara asked.
One moment, said the doctor.
We're waiting for Chatterton.
Good morning, doctor, said Ian, as he walked in a moment later.
Barbara, Victoria?
Vicky, said Vicky, irritably.
Why don't you like to be called by your full name? I thought it was polite.
I keep telling you, Vicky is my full name.
How good of you to join us, said the doctor. My friends, I have something very special to announce.
He turned to Vicky and whispered loudly.
Go on.
Vicky leaned forward and hit the button that operated the scanner. The doctor had helpfully labelled it earlier with a thick black marker pen. The screen hummed into life, revealing a grand building made of grey stone. Its entrance was flanked by pillars and topped with a small dome.
That's the National Gallery,
Barbara exclaimed. The doctor gripped his lapels and looked at her and Ian proudly.
Mr. Chesterton and Miss Wright,
might I be the first to welcome you to London on the 23rd of November, 1963?
Barbara made her way down towards the embankment. Progress was slow, as she had to weave around the figures caught in mid-stride on the pavement. Finally, she overcame her inhibitions and walked in the middle of the road, between the stationary vehicles. She glanced occasionally at the occupants. One car held a young couple. The woman, with her arms folded anxiously across her rounded belly, the man gripping the wheel tightly. His mouth was open, and he was frowning slightly. Barbara guessed that he had been offering his wife words of reassurance just at the time that he was frozen. She felt tense, expectant, as if at any moment the cars would begin to move again, the whole bustle and chatter of London life erupt around her. When she reached the river, she headed towards the Houses of Parliament. On the clock face of Big Ben, the hands stood immobile at exactly 1:15. Instinctively, she glanced at her own watch. But its second hand continued to move. Her own arbitrary measurement of day and night, hours and minutes, was ticking away.
Barbara!
A voice shouted. It carried perfectly in the stillness of the day. She found it difficult to determine exactly where it came from.
Barbara!
She glanced up at Westminster Bridge. The traffic and people were as immobile as everywhere else in the city.
Barbara! Down here!
Barbara looked down. Halfway across the river stood Ian, waving his arms. He was walking on the water. The doctor's initial pride at having successfully returned them to their own time had quickly turned to panic when the passers-by and flocks of pigeons on the screen failed to move. The old man had blamed the scanner at first, turning it off and on, swiveling the camera, adjusting the sound and colour. Then suddenly, without a word, he had ducked underneath the console and ripped one of the panels out.
Vicky,
he said,
fetch the toolkit. There's a good girl.
What's going on?
Barbara asked Ian. The two of them sat cross-legged on the water. It was hard, like glass underneath, but not cold.
Everything's frozen, that's for sure. But as to why? Well, your guess is as good as mine. Do you think the Earth's been attacked?
Said Barbara.
I don't know,
Ian replied.
It would be a good time to do it, though, wouldn't it? What do you mean?
I mean, Kennedy's just been assassinated. One of the most powerful nations on Earth is paralyzed.
Yeah, it's possible,
Barbara admitted.
It might not even be aliens,
said Ian.
It could be the Russians. Oh, Ian!
Barbara laughed despite herself.
Don't be absurd. Well, we've already seen the world nearly come to an end once without any help from outside,
said Ian.
In our time, I mean.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, Barbara thought. She remembered it vividly. She'd gone to bed expecting every night to be her last. Once, at 3 in the morning, she'd been woken by the sound of sirens. It had turned out to be a fire in one of the houses at the end of her street. But for a moment, she had thought that this was it. The Americans and the Russians were fighting, and the world was at an end.
This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper,
she recited.
What's that?
Said Ian.
Poetry? T.S. Eliot. Oh,
Ian replied.
I think I prefer his stuff about the cats. Anyway, it doesn't look like things have ended at all. More ground to a halt. The 23rd of November, 1963. Forever. Wait a minute.
Barbara stood up abruptly. She lost her grip on the smooth surface of the water. In an instant, Ian shot to his feet and put out his arm to steady her.
What is it?
He asked.
The 23rd of November. It's my Aunt Cecilia's birthday. I was supposed to meet her. I'd forgotten all about it. Where?
Asked Ian.
Not far away, actually.
She replied.
There's a lion's on the strand she always liked. I remember you telling me about her,
said Ian.
Maiden aunt, wasn't she?
Well, not quite, thought Barbara, but kept it to herself.
Oh, Ian, can we try to find her? It may not be a good idea,
said Ian cautiously.
I want to see her,
said Barbara.
Just briefly. Then we'll go back to the TARDIS and see if the doctor's worked out what's happening.
Fortunately, the freeze had occurred at the exact moment that someone was pushing open the door of the Lion's Corner House on the Strand. It was a woman in her mid-twenties, holding the hand of a small child, wrapped up in a duffel coat and woolen hat. Barbara and Ian stepped around them and into the interior of the cafe. At the nearest table to the door sat Barbara's aunt, Cecilia. She was a woman in her late 40s, with severely cropped dark hair, wearing a closely cut tweed jacket. She had a novel open in her left hand, something called The Price of Salt, and with her right, she was raising a teacup to her lips. Her eyes peered over the top of her book. She was looking in the direction of the door, perhaps alerted by the sound of the woman and child coming in. Barbara had the strangest feeling for one moment that Cecilia was actually staring directly at her, that she was about to rise from her seat and deliver one of her usual sardonic remarks. She was waiting for me, Barbara whispered to Ian, just like she did every year. But I never came. Ian didn't reply. Ian, said Barbara, what is it? Do you realize, said Ian, that we don't have reflections? Barbara looked up. It was true. She was standing in front of a large panel of silvered glass. She felt suddenly as if her very existence was in question, that at any moment she might dissolve. She walked up close and tapped on it.
Ian! Barbara!
Vicky was leaning through the door of the restaurant. She looked flushed and breathless.
Come back to the TARDIS. The doctor's found out what's wrong.
A simple thing, said the doctor. But simple things can easily be our undoing. For want of a nail,
What's happened to London? Barbara asked.
Oh, my dear, London is much the same as it ever was. The fault lies with the ship.
You mean the TARDIS caused this? Ian sounded indignant.
Rest assured, my boy. London is safe. Then why is it frozen?
The doctor rapped the console firmly with his knuckles.
There was a problem, he said, with the heartbeat of the TARDIS. The TARDIS has a heart?
Barbara asked. The doctor nodded.
In a manner of speaking, a strong and regular pulse is vital.
Why? Because when the TARDIS lands, my dear, it must continue travelling forwards in time at the same speed as its owner. Too slowly, and it would vanish into the past. Too quickly, and it would hair off into the future. The heartbeat of the TARDIS works to synchronize the ship with its pilot's time frame. Now, because of a slight mechanical fault, the heartbeat of the TARDIS began to skip, to become irregular.
You mean, said Ian, we could have lost the TARDIS?
Oh, no, not at all. There's no chance of that. You see, if a heartbeat begins to fail, the TARDIS materializes at a single static point in time. That way, we can mend the ship and continue on our journey.
But why now? Asked Barbara.
Why London?
The doctor began tidying away his tools.
That, Barbara, is a mystery. Perhaps she's growing fond of the city. You never know.
Is it fixed? Asked Ian.
As good as new,
said the doctor, struggling to fit a wrench into the bulging tool bag.
Perhaps better. Can't you just set time running again?
The doctor shook his head, avoiding their glance.
I'm sorry, he said.
I really am so sorry, but that isn't possible. You see, I can't kick-start time again. Nothing of that sort. We can only dematerialize and then, well, who knows where we'll land after that?
So, we're as far from home as ever, said Barbara.
I'm afraid so, my dear, the doctor replied gently.
I wish I could give you better news. However, I can delay our departure for a couple of hours if you would like one last look around.
Barbara and Ian looked at each other. It's quite all right, said Barbara. We are ready to leave now. In London, on the 23rd of November 1963, a man was discovered dead in an alley near Trafalgar Square. His murderer was never found. A baby was born, and his parents called him John Fitzgerald. In a Lion's Corner house on the Strand, a middle-aged woman waited for her niece, who was late, 15 minutes late. To be precise, but the woman didn't mind. She was quite absorbed in the book she was reading. There was something strange in the air that day, as if the assassination of the American president, thousands of miles away, had marked the end of an era and perhaps the beginning of a new era, one of change and violence and a wild sort of freedom. No doubt there were some people that just for one moment wished they could stop time from moving relentlessly on and keep everything exactly as it was forever.